Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, December 9th, 2014. After 2 years of wrangling, heavy redactions, the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on torture, detention, and rendition has been partially published.
Never sends you an omen. A revolution just arrived like the morning. Ring the alarm, we come to wake up the snoring. They're telling you to never worry about the future. They're telling you to never worry about the torture.
Yeah, don't worry about the torture. Michael Fronte and Spearhead released Yell Fire in the middle of the last decade. And while Dianne Feinstein, senior senator from California, a Democrat who has chaired the Intelligence Committee for the past few years, is hardly one to yell fire in a crowded theater or elsewhere, she has been one of the most reliable protectors, defenders, and apologists for the intelligence community, ranging from the NSA's massive surveillance of Americans to the rendition and detention. And she takes exception to the torture part. And clearly this has bothered Senator Feinstein. My own speculation is that she feels a sense of guilt and shame because she was briefed on at least what was reported by the CIA to the intelligence committees and to the executive branch. We're learning from this report that the CIA played a lot of games, didn't completely report what it was up to. At least that appears to be where Senator Feinstein feels compromised. And so let me first tell you that I've had a hell of a day. My internet connection went down this morning and was out for 5 hours and just came back a few minutes ago before I sat down here to talk with you. And I had carved out several hours to review the published accounts of the Senate committee report. It's really just the redacted executive summary that we're seeing. And so I am working, with both hands behind my back, tied there. but I want to thank Pierre from AT&T, who came out and reported that a technician somewhere else in town managed to cut my wires. I won't suggest that it was intentional. And so today I will have to leave you with a limited summary of what is in the report. And then over the next few days, I will offer more commentary. And of course, we'll get some in-depth interviews going in the next week or so as well. But from the New York Times summary, 7 key points from the CIA torture report: that the interrogation techniques were more brutal and employed more extensively than the agency portrayed. Now, to me, the critical issue is to see where the Times uses the word torture. Because we hear about techniques, enhanced interrogation techniques, methods. So, this summary says, the report describes extensive waterboarding as a series of near drownings, and suggests that more prisoners were subjected to waterboarding than the 3 that the CIA has acknowledged in the past. Now, we've known that. We couldn't prove it, but we've known it. The report also describes prisoners being subjected to sleep deprivation for up to a week, medically unnecessary rectal feeding, and death threats. Conditions at one prison described by a clandestine officer as a dungeon were blamed for the death of a detainee, and the harsh techniques, see, they don't say torture, were described as leading to psychological and behavioral issues like hallucinations, paranoia, insomnia, and attempts at self-harm and self-mutilation. And don't forget the reports we've had for years from Jason Leopold and Dr. Jeff Kay that the anti-malaria drug mefloquine, it's hard to pronounce, was applied to every prisoner who arrived at Guantanamo, and it wasn't about malaria. It was about the psychotic side effects that the drug produced. We'll see if that shows up in this report. Item 2, the CIA interrogation program was mismanaged, not subject to adequate oversight. Well, they knew that the intelligence committees didn't want to know the grisly details. They knew that the White House had written a blank check and said, you know, try not to kill him, but we want you to, quote-unquote, produce intelligence. We don't care about the human side of what happens to the sources. Item 3. The CIA misled members of Congress and the White House about the effectiveness and extent of its brutal interrogation techniques. See, they couldn't say torture. The report says the agency provided false and misleading information to members of Congress, the White House, the Director of National Intelligence. Now, in my opinion, this is what they call deniability. When senior officials signal to their underlings, hey, don't tell me. I don't need to know. I don't want to know. And I'll be curious to see if this report explores deniability in any way. Item 4. Interrogators in the field who tried to stop the brutal techniques were repeatedly overruled by senior CIA officials. We know that on many occasions, the torture sessions were being micromanaged from Washington. Condoleezza Rice at one point expressed discomfort about doing that from the White House. So, is this a surprise? Not to me. Item 5, the CIA repeatedly underreported the number of people it detained and subjected to harsh interrogation techniques under the program. See, again, they couldn't say torture. And that is a lie. I mean, there were a whole series of lies. We know that. They claimed at one point that there were fewer than 100 individuals held at black sites, but it was at least 119. And by and large, the CIA just operated as a rogue agency because they had the approval of the White House and the silence of Capitol Hill. And this report is based on the premise that there will be no action taken by the courts because there will be no prosecutions based on this new review. Item 6, at least 26 prisoners were wrongfully held and didn't meet the government standard for detention. 26? Now, that's of the 119 held at the black sites. And where are they? Have they been released, or are they still trapped at Guantanamo or at the Parwan prison in Afghanistan? Or on Diego Garcia? Truth is, we don't know. And item 7 in this summary, the CIA leaked classified information to journalists, exaggerating the success of interrogation methods in an effort to gain public support. Well, and they had willing, complicit partners, not only in journalism, but in media. And I noted on the schedule for Jon Stewart's Daily Show this week that Catherine Bigelow, who produced Zero Dark Thirty, which was clearly a partnership with the CIA. I mean, they had Tony Soprano play the part of Leon Panetta. And so the media does, I think, share the guilt and responsibility for many of these barbaric efforts as it underreported, shaded the reporting, and sat on information that whistleblowers gave it time and time again. So this is interesting. As I say, I am hamstrung today because of my internet problems, and I regret that I can't give you more full comment, but I will. And so I hope you'll keep listening. Yesterday in Kabul, the North American Treaty Organization, NATO, held a change of command ceremony. The NATO coalition is exiting, essentially leaving it all in the laps of the United States. And it's a bizarre event because we all know that while NATO is ending its mission in Afghanistan, the war continues on an open-ended basis. We can't believe any of the representations from the Obama administration because they've been repeatedly proven to be false. Or were they just accurate at the time and the situation changed? In any event, President Obama personally has made a series of promises about Afghanistan that simply haven't been borne out. Are they lies? Were they intentional? I'll leave that for your judgment. But it is fair to say that the troop levels have dropped from 140,000 back in 2011 to what we're told is 13,300 total in Afghanistan today. Meanwhile, the wars of choice embraced by George W. Bush have produced massive displacement of humans and major humanitarian crises, particularly in the Middle East. There are now, by the estimate of the United Nations, 57 million displaced people in 22 countries. Nearly three-quarters of them are in Syria, Iraq, South Sudan, and Sudan itself. The UN estimates a need for $16 billion for humanitarian assistance in the coming year. The number of people currently displaced by conflict has reached the highest level since World War II. And speaking of human rights and similar issues, Israel is trying to get out in front and control investigations into allegations of war crimes committed this past summer in the 51-day assault on the Gaza Strip. Now, Israel had launched a series of criminal investigations, about five of them. Yesterday, they announced eight additional incidents will be investigated. But bizarrely, they issued a 21-page report clearing Israeli troops and commanders in seven cases, including strikes on two hospitals, an ambulance, a clinic for the disabled, a Red Crescent station, and a United Nations office. And as Bill Van Esveld at Human Rights Watch notes, while it's always good to see more investigations, Israel has a terrible record. The poor track record of past investigations and the lack of accountability don't give much hope that the same process will yield a just outcome this time. Amnesty International called this one of the incidents a grossly disproportionate attack. That was the July 20th bombing of the Abu Jama family in Khan Yunis, southern Gaza. 25 members of the family, 19 of them children, were killed. And tomorrow evening, I am going to be interviewing Professor Richard Falk, who was a guest on a podcast here a few weeks back, and he is coming to the Bay Area to speak to a group at the First Presbyterian Church of San Anselmo. I'm looking forward to speaking with him. He, of course, is an international expert on humanitarian law. And he was chosen to be the UN Rapporteur for Human Rights in Palestine from 2008 to 2014. He is outspoken and candid, and I'm very much looking forward to that conversation. Every day, I like to pause for a moment and thank the people who support my activities here with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Eric Snyder, Jeffrey Gill, Kevin Beckley, and Carl Harrison. They're all subscribers here, and I'd like you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the link called Sign Up right under my picture on the homepage. That takes you to an option page. You can choose $5 a month, $10, $20, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And I just got a new subscriber, got an email about that recently. Not sure who it is, but we'll acknowledge you in the next few days, and I appreciate that. But come on in and join the effort here. I would appreciate it. Just pick one of those levels if you can afford it. And if you choose the new annual subscription, the $50 level, I've got a bonus gift for you. It's an ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's powerful new book called Empire of Chaos. Well, the New York Times has been interesting the last few Sundays, publishing lengthy exposés about the energy industry. A few weeks back, they exposed the downside of the shale oil boom in North Dakota. And in this past Sunday's paper, they exposed the role of Republican state attorneys general in doing the bidding of the energy industry and related interests, doing the bidding of their industry lobbyists. And they focus on Scott Pruitt in particular. He's the attorney general of the state of Oklahoma. You won't be surprised to know that he's a Republican. And he's been cozying up to those who want to limit, if not just completely eliminate, any role for the Environmental Protection Agency in state activities. They say the states are better positioned to regulate these industries, when in fact they don't want to regulate them, and they are attacking the EPA for the limited efforts it makes to cut down on the smog and haze that comes from burning coal and many other environmental problems. And what's fascinating is that the Times exposes that Scott Pruitt gets a lot of helping hands. Energy industry lobbyists drafted letters for him to send to the EPA, the Interior Department, the Office of Management and Budget, and even President Obama. And there is an elderly man named Andrew Miller from West Virginia who is a good and great friend of the coal and oil industries. He's a former attorney general of the state of Virginia, not West Virginia. That was my mistake. And he has been basically facilitating contacts between lobbyists and people like Attorney General Scott Pruitt. And the Times even publishes, side by side, a letter that was written by a lobbyist named Bill Witsit. He works for Devon Energy Company in Oklahoma City. And he drafted a letter for the signature of Scott Pruitt. And Pruitt's office just put it on letterhead, changed a couple of words, and sent it off nearly verbatim. And that's a real smoking gun about just how much control the energy industry has over Republican state officials. And in the past, we had attorneys general who would band together to fight against a polluter, to fight against a source of pollution that crosses state lines, for example. And now the trend is in the opposite direction, where attorneys general are banding together to try to repeal or undermine Obamacare and to do whatever they can to limit the effectiveness of the EPA. Over at the Justice Department, after 5 years of work, Eric Holder has released a new policy on racial profiling. And many people will think this is direct response to Ferguson, to Staten Island. And frankly, it's not. But it comes at a time when many people will make that linkage. And what is interesting is that the new rules will curtail the use of profiling, except at the airport, at the border, and in so-called national security cases. And so this might protect an individual who in the past might be picked up for driving while black in a major city. But when that same person goes to the airport, or if someone who looks like a Muslim goes to the airport, or if they are caught up in some sort of an alleged national security investigation, well, those rules will not apply. And frankly, I find that incoherent, but not surprising. Did you know that in the state of Maryland, if you are an avowed atheist, you can't hold public office? I didn't know that. This story was published just a couple of days ago, And there are some lawsuits underway, and there's some legislative action underway, because in six other states besides Maryland, there are various limits placed in the Constitution. Like the one in Maryland, it says people who don't believe in God are not eligible to hold public office. Maryland's Constitution says belief in God is a requirement even for jurors and witnesses in a court proceeding. The other states are Arkansas, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas. The Mississippi Constitution reads, "No person who denies the existence of a supreme being shall hold any office in this state." North Carolina says, "The following person shall be disqualified for office. First, any person who shall deny the being of Almighty God." And in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, there's no explicit prohibition, but it says that no one can be disqualified from serving in office on the basis of religion as long as they believe in God and a future state of rewards and punishments, you know, heaven and hell. So I was stunned to hear about this. It seems so 17th century. And finally today, a few days ago, somebody linked me up on Facebook with a music video fronted by an unknown country music artist, a guy in a cowboy hat, who croons a country and western song about Hillary Clinton. And this was produced by the group that we're told has no connection to Ms. Clinton and her aspirations to run for president in 2016. It's called Ready for Hillary. And actually, a group that was recently started on Facebook, and you can find them and join them if you like, Democrats Against Hillary Clinton for President in 2016. They were the ones who posted this, at least that I saw. And as somebody who works, you know, in my day job as a marketing consultant, I looked at this video and I said, wow, what does it say? Well, the singer says that Hillary is one great lady. She's a mother, a daughter, and through it all, she's a loving wife. And I guess they're trying to, you know, repackage Hillary in an effort to capture the white vote. And I find this very surprising at a time when the Democratic Party enjoys a strong lead, dominance in both the African American and Latino voting communities in this country. And this music video, which includes two scenes where they use a sledgehammer to smash a glass ceiling, it's aimed at the people who have stopped voting for Democrats. Mary Landrieu, who lost her runoff election in Louisiana last Saturday, was the last statewide Democrat elected in the South. And so when I look at this video, it makes me scratch my head. Why do they think that appealing to conservative white country music-loving, redneck-leaning individuals is an important component of the electorate for a Hillary Clinton victory in 2016. So we'll give Roy Rogers the day off today for our ending music, and here is the video, at least the music from it, the audio that I mentioned, and you can find it on YouTube if you do a search, Stand With Hillary. Check it out.
Looking back in time, learning hindsight's always right. We came together in no way. wait or to find a moment we all can celebrate. And now it's 2016, and this time I'm a thinking, guys, put your boots on and let's smash this ceiling. No, I've been thinking about one great lady like the women in my life. She's a mother, a daughter, and through it all, she's a loving wife. Oh, there is something about her, this great lady, caring, hardworking, once a first lady. She fights for country and my family. Now it's time for us to stand up. This great land in a red or a blue state, cause our American dream is at stake, and there's some hard choices that need.